This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. This movie is directed by George Roy Hill, written by William Goldman, produced by John Foreman, and starring Paul Newman, Robert Redford, Catherine Ross, Strother Martin, Jeff Corey, Henry Jones, and a ton of other character actors. Cinematography by Conrad Hall, edited by John C. Howard and Richard C. Mayer, music by the legendary Burt Bacharach, and produced by Company Productions and the Newman Foreman Company. This movie is distributed by 20th Century Fox. It was released on September 23rd, 1969. It has a running time of 110 minutes and reportedly a budget of $6 million. This movie raked in North America alone $102.3 million. How are you guys?
I'm good. I'm slightly back from holiday, so everything's all a bit wrong. If you like piña coladas and getting caught in the rain, if you're not into yoga, if you have half a brain.
You're slightly back from holiday.
Yeah, slightly.
Okay. Okay.
Which I find hilarious because there was a slight delay there in your response. I was just thinking, hi, I'm all right.
Good. Yeah, you had a haircut.
Yes, I had a haircut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that we didn't mention this before we started recording.
It's funny talking to you, Umbar, about this because it's probably been a long time since this has happened to you. However...
Oh no!
Oh,
I still have to shave the bum fluff, which is really annoying, to be honest.
So this was what I was going to say. You know, at the moment, when my hair grows out, it's pretty dark. But then when they start cutting it, all the grays properly start coming out, and I only notice it as it falls down.
Yeah, you look like an Indian George Clooney. That's it. You're going
salt
and pepper.
That's what I'm going for. Yeah.
A quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what is this movie about?
Two famous bank robbers and train robbers are finally meeting their match as they travel across South America.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, isn't it?
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. I really enjoyed, because I completely forgot so much about this film. Of course, the finale is... film history, but I completely enjoyed the moment where the posse jumps out of that train and you just watch them run away for about 20 minutes. I completely forgot it was like 20 minutes of just running away.
Yeah, it's great.
I that's what the fascination that I had with this. First of all, worth noting to our listeners why we decided to do this movie. At some point, we're going to do it, but we are recording this shortly after the passing of the legendary Robert Redford. He died at the age of 89, so he had a pretty good run, legendary on so many different levels, not just on an actor, but as an actor, but also he's the grandfather and one of the founders, if not the main founder, of the Sundance Film Festival. So there are many tales about Robert Redford wanting to, at a time in which it was impossible to do, to pull away from Hollywood. He went out of his way to, you know, once he got to a certain level of notoriety, to have his residence as far away as possible from California as well, or from Hollywood, because he wanted a separation between his familial life or his personal life. But he was also a decent dude. So you could easily argue that he's the grandfather of independent cinema, you know. Why this movie? As we are watching this movie, because I actually like to do a fresh watch as close as possible to the time we record. I actually watched it this morning, and Annie's beginning to join me sometimes. Even if this was a Western, she remembered somehow, because we watched it before several times, or I've seen it several times, that this was an unconventional Western. In fact, this is one of the greatest examples of revisionism. This is a revisionist Western. Came out in 1969, throughout the, you know, a cultural revolution, and we are going to discuss this as well today, because there's a lot of nods to, there's a lot of messages about, you know, moving away from the mold of many things that were standardized at that time. But it's a super entertaining film. And the thing that really, really kind of sticks out for me now, it's almost stupid that I didn't. I always identified, I believe in generational kind of cycles when it comes down to actors and like almost like molds, like the molds that we mentioned, that I just mentioned before. There are like a model for what's coming next. If you look at the, because man, obviously Paul Newman and Redford here exude cool. They really do, man. Like from the moment you see the way he's lit and everything, Paul Newman looks fucking amazing in this. He really does. But there's certain mannerisms and things that I didn't notice before. Look at Brad Pitt acting and look at Paul Newman acting.
Yeah.
Even the way he moves his body, everything. It's a carbon copy. And I always associated Brad Pitt as like a new, like a Redford for the new generation, well, right? But in this one...
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually, like, I can see how he must have idolized Newman because he acts exactly in the same way. Like, the squint, the head turns, the way he moves his body from action back to static. Like, it's very Brad Pitt. It blew my mind that I never noticed it before,
so
before this viewing.
I've always seen Robert Redford and Brad Pitt as the archetypal features, you know, but not the acting style being Paul Newman. Which is, again, yeah, I noticed it on this. It's very, very similar. It's crazy.
And also, man, Paul Newman turns up the funny in this, dude. Like, fucking hilarious. And he doesn't have to do much. Like, his delivery is great, but it's just his persona is fantastic. Like, we're going to discuss it, but the entire, like, I laughed out loud in some bits in this.
I was just going to throw something facetiously in. He might just have been a pothead of the era, just like Brad Pitt is now.
Maybe. I always thought he was a drinker, and so is Brad Pitt, apparently. Brad Pitt's a drinker, a heavy drinker. Like,
they're both definitely drinkers, because the stories about this movie and the making of this movie. Did any of you guys watch DVD extras or like the making of?
I saw some, but a lot of them were of the time period, so not much. Talking about the fun they had on set.
There's an entire story about the fact that the rest of the cast got what was, and I mean, they call it Montezuma's Revenge. I'd never come up with this other than the fact that Montezuma's Revenge for me is a C64 game. But now I understand.
It's the shits, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So basically, the rest of the cast drank water. The three primary actors drank beer and soda. That's all they drank during the entire Mexican sequences in this.
This includes Catherine Ross?
Yeah.
And they never got sick.
And she's
absolutely beautiful in this. And yeah, I mean, like, so subtle. She's perfect. I looked at her career. I mean, I think she should have been treated better by Hollywood. I don't know. But in this... She's phenomenal, and she's an like integral member of the team as well. Like, if without her, there would be something missing. The way they bounce off her, as well, is essential. But this movie is a weird animal, man, because it's got to be the inception of at least the type of body comedy or the body cop trope. You know, all those movies, like, what would you call it? Like a body, what's it called?
A buddy movie, really?
Yeah, it's interesting that one of the people who originally was meant to be in this film is Jack Lemmon, because there is definitely an odd couple sort of
there
vibe.
There is a little bit of that. But they're akin to one another. You know, like, they're not... That's not... I don't think that... I think the chemistry here is not that they're... That there's a friendship and there are polar opposites. I think here they just have age, which, by the way, I checked this. Fuck, man, Paul Newman was only 44 in this.
Yeah,
it's just people age differently, but he also still looked cool. And Redford was about 34, so they were 10 years apart. You know what I mean?
But Goldman actually originally wrote this for both Newman and for Jack Lemmon. And
I'm glad it didn't go that way, man.
But what I mean is that there are some scenes, especially early on, where Butch Cassidy is sort of having like these little soliloquies, monologues that are very Jack Lemmon-esque. You know, they are that sort of like that canter, that almost vaudevillian ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. While Robert Redford, being the Sundance Kid, is being that stoic, barely saying anything, but being so damn cool about it.
You have a valid point here, because he's always like Redford's character. Well, Sundance is always saying to him, you know, you do what you do best, which is, you know, do the thinking thing. But yet again, Paul Newman doesn't come across as a neurotic character, because it's impossible for him to play that. You need to have some kind of nerdy quality, and Lemmon would have been perfect for that. But fuck, man. Newman is cool as fuck in this. Yep. Like that opening sequence, it's just his features. He's got that slight squint, and how the movie opens sepia and then goes to color, it's almost essential, because it was a thing of the era, but also it's the setting. A Western would always have this, particularly through the summer or the spring or whatever, you always have these burned out tones. Colors are kind of muted. They're not, you know, there's nothing vivid. But when it goes to color, it feels like it's going to color. And it's, and also that opening sequence, the way it's framed and the way the light play, whoever lit this movie, we're going to talk about that as well, because the cinematographer in this, he knows what he's doing. Some of this movie is gorgeous. It looks absolutely gorgeous. But also the framing, like we said earlier, it's masterfully made. Perfect. It was just a pleasure to watch. It was just an absolute pleasure to watch. I was a little tired, I got to say. And, you know, if it was made in any other way, this movie would be a tonal disaster. But it's not. And also, they lean into the comedy, but it feels organic. It's not. Even there's one scene that goes so over the top that feels slapstick. The sequence with the bicycle, the entire thing. But it's so self-aware that it works. You know what I mean? Like, otherwise, what's the song in the background behind that?
Raindrops keep falling on your head.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Raindrops are falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. So I just did me some talking to the sun, and I said I didn't like the way he got things done. Sleeping on the job, those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. But there's one thing I know.
It's funny that you did mention the tone, because later on I will be the one who will be talking negatively about the tonal shifts throughout this film. But you mentioned the intro. One of our favorites was at the poker table. Did anybody recognize it? The first time you watched this, did anybody recognize Sam Elliott at that poker table?
Fuck you.
I didn't. I did not.
Did you?
You're joking.
Sam Elliott.
Yeah, without
no,
a
tashi. No, it's not.
Yeah, without a tashi tashi.
You're joking. The guy's standing up going, I didn't know you were Sundance.
Yeah, without
no.
the tashi tashi tashi. Yeah, I'll even take a picture right now.
Oh,
and I'll send it
God.
In.
Man, that's crazy. I'm just going to say one thing.
Steve, you didn't recognize him either.
I didn't recognize him.
That's bananas. What are you doing?
So it's
what are you
stash,
doing? What's
isn't
Ricky
it?
Doing? He's taking a picture with his phone. What the fuck are you doing?
I took a picture of the image I have on the screen so I can send it to the group.
Are you going to remove Sam Elliott's moustache with Photoshop? And
No. I'm just going to send it into the group, the shot I have from the sepia moment, blah, 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 blah.
Should I get a dry erase marker and just draw a moustache over the photo that you sent me?
Yes. Yes, please do.
Okay, I can do it.
This kind of situation... where we've got a director this is one of their favorite films, and we can actually see how he's structured his movies office. And this is David Fincher. This is one of David Fincher's favorite movies.
Yes.
Oh, now we understand that pissy sepia.
Yeah, the sepia or amber tones, for sure, man. Holy shit. Well, I think this is like the favorite movie of a lot of directors.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what's the name of the guy that wrote Little Weapon and all those movies? What's his name?
Who's in Predator.
Yeah, he wrote that as well. What's his
name? Black.
Black.
Yeah, Sean Black. Is that his name? Yeah. Or Shane Black?
Shane Black.
I can tell you. That's everything he writes, because there's a moment, there's a lot of moments in this one in which I thought of Marta and Riggs as well. You know, like the entire jumping. It's like, but I can't swim with it.
Ready? No, we'll jump. Like hell we will. No, it'll be okay. If the water's deep enough, we don't get squished to death. He'll never follow us.
How do you know?
Would you make a jump like that you didn't have to?
I have to, and I'm not gonna.
Well, we got to, otherwise we're dead. They're just gonna have to go back down the same way they come. Come on.
Just one clear shot, that's all I want.
Come on. We got to.
Up. Get away from me.
Why?
I want to fight them.
They'll kill us.
Maybe.
You want to die?
Do you?
All right. I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim!
The chemistry between them is fucking phenomenal. And it builds as their friendship builds. And we see that happen. There is a sequence, which, by the way, for context, I think it's right after they pull the first train robbery that we see, where they hit the same financier or whatever, who then this becomes their downfall, basically, over time. But they don't realize the extent that someone would go to protect their investment, and, you know, it leads to the end of this movie. But they do that. They go to celebrate. They go to the whorehouse, where they would usually go, and they're on the balcony. And they're overlooking what's happening. So the city is trying to take action, basically, to prevent them. But they're watching it because they have no idea. So they think they're above the law, because they're literally above the law. Like, they are on a balcony above the marshal doing a speech for the town. And the guy doing the speech, who's credited as marshal, is an actor called Kenneth Mars. And the moment he came on, I was like, don't get your phone. Please don't get your phone. And I'm looking at this guy's feature, and I'm thinking, I know this guy. Do you remember Malcolm in the Middle?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember there's an entire season where Francis, after the army, Francis is the older brother, he moves to a ranch somewhere, and there's Otto and his wife. Otto is the German guy who's hilarious, by the way. That guy is Kenneth Mars, and he's the marshal, right? But in that sequence, as they are overlooking this, they're drinking beer, you can see that it's like they had several. And all of a sudden, there's something essential that happens between these two, which is... And it drops so naturally. So, the movie is well-written. You know, that conversation feels natural. And they dropped each other's names for the first time. You know, they've been, you know, pulling scores together but all of a sudden, they're on a first-name basis. Which, by the way, it still shows how cautious Sundance is. You know, there's a lot of subtlety in that scene. When that sequence is over and they get up from that table on the balcony, the last thing that you see is Redford picking up his gun from the chair under the table. I don't know if you noticed that. So he's you know, obviously I didn't know much about the Sundance kid. Those names are their real names, the names that they exchange during that sequence. But he was given that nickname. That's why Sundance Kid, because he went to jail really young and spent a long time in it. Apparently, he was given that nickname in prison.
Yeah, in Sundance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, it's also interesting that you brought up where they go to hide every time they do a hit. Let's
the whorehouse,
call it.
Yeah.
But one of the prostitutes at the whorehouse is Cloris Leachman. She is the one that always goes up with Paul Newman, with Butch Cassidy.
Yeah, she was also... Was she Malcolm in the Middle? She plays the...
Yep.
No, she was... Yeah, but she was also in another show called Raising Hope. And she plays the grandmother there as well.
Yes. She was Ida for 11 episodes of Malcolm in the Middle. So that's another deep dive. She's fantastic.
She's horrible.
Yeah.
She's fucking horrible, right? She sues the family in Malcolm in the Middle at one point because she has herself in the house. She's really funny.
Yeah.
And it was a surprise to see her in the same role in Raising Hope, which is kind of, you know, not a carbon copy of Malcolm in the Middle, but it's that kind of thing. Those shows, you had Malcolm in the Middle, you had, it was a particular formula, and you had The Middle as well later on. You know what I mean? Same family. Yeah.
Like, so I know her mainly from like stuff like cameos and stuff like the Muppets movies or any Mel Brooks films, because she was big in Young Frankenstein.
She's in Frankenstein Jr., right?
Yeah, Young Frankenstein, yeah.
She's Frau Blücher, whatever her name is.
Well done. You got that exactly right, yeah.
How do you pronounce it? Frau?
You said it just... Yeah, exactly
Blücher.
Right.
Yeah. Blücher?
Blücher. But she was also in the Last Picture Show and she had a really great role in that as well. But it's so funny seeing her in 1968, 1969, where, you know, she's more well-known for her older stages, especially for our generation, than she was for this stage.
Because I remember from American Gods, she was in, like, two or three episodes as Zoira.
She was as well.
Zoira? Yeah.
But about this being a revisionist Western, there's, you know, and this would probably lead into the topic that you wanted to discuss, Ricky, about the tonal shift. But I also, the sequence in particular, I almost forgot about this movie. And it kind of, because otherwise you veer into Easy Rider territory. And there are, you know, you could say that there's that friendship kind of thing and going against, right? I think this movie is more focused on, it doesn't insist upon a particular topic. Everything in this movie kind of services the story more. But there's one very poignant scene that I forgot about. And it's when they decide to go straight. When they decide to go straight, there's the thing that it's revealed, which is actually supported by everything that comes before it as well. Because, you know, these are criminals. They're fucking criminals. But you can see that the way, and I'm sure that it wasn't like that at all. So there's a lot of romanticism injected into the story. But the way Butch Cassidy is portrayed here is as someone who sees this as a profession. He doesn't want people to get hurt. It really doesn't. In fact, the entire thing back and forth with Mr. Woodcock, that's fucking hilarious.
That is great.
It is. But there's a moment that's really sad, and it made me sad. And it's when they shoot the robbers in Bolivia. Right after that, he reveals something, and you know it's not bullshitting. It's like, I never killed anybody. And you believe it. And it's kind of bittersweet because I don't know if this was riffing on the military or riffing on the police force or what happens when you go straight. Because technically, they were enforcing some kind of law. They went straight for a second there. And that's when he killed someone for the first time. So not to mention the fact that, you know, there would be a lot of introspection as well, because you've just killed somebody who does what you do for a living, you know?
Yeah.
I thought that was, you know, I completely forgot. That was the saddest part of this movie for me. And for a second, it pulled me out completely.
Yeah. And when you look at it, it is 1969, isn't it? This was produced. So it's
right
on
the middle
cusp
of the Vietnam War. It's a cultural revolution. There's.
So, tonal shift.
Now,
we got a bit sad.
Yeah. And segue into tonal shifts. one of the things that is interesting about this film is how there's probably only four straight Western style scenes in this. Number one was the intro scene where we get introduced to the Sundance Kid. At the poker table, that is truly almost Sergio Leone's style introduction of a character. Then, of course, the finale. But the soundtrack being by Burt Bacharach,
it's elevator music,
has
dude.
A lot of moments where all of a sudden you're sort of like, oh, okay, so I know. Like one of the Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, the fact that it comes straight after a very suggestive scene where it's all consensual. The scene is consensual.
Yeah, I know.
You find out
like
by the end of it.
When he's sitting down, it's like, get undressed.
Get undressed. Slower. Take slowly. Laura off.
Slowly.
Like, I wish you'd just come in and say hello.
you knew it was coming, right? You know it was coming.
But anyway. But yeah. No,
people role play. People role play, right?
Okay, so, all right. I'm not shaming a kink here or anything, but it was a bit like, yeah. Anyway, and then followed by raindrops keep falling on my head. Anyway,
on my head. That's fucked up.
But because of the music and because of the bike scene, and I know the bike scene's infamous, but straight away I shouted out to Sally, I think I'm watching Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And Chitty Chitty Bang Bang came out a year before this. So I was like, maybe there's a little bit. So there's the odd time in this film where the tonal shift is really, really strange. The second sepia montage scene, again, because of the a cappella 60s styles.
I was looking for that track because I love it. I love it. I would have that track as a soundtrack to my life. I will speakers left and right on my shoulders. Whatever I go,
would you go to New York in a brown shitty filter while you're doing
it? Yeah, but wait a second. That's it happens twice, and the time when it's so kind of what the fuck is this music doing here is the entire montage of them robbing people in Bolivia.
Yeah, yes.
That's when you get the. Yeah. Which, by the way, I gotta tell you, the entire sequence. Where he goes in to the bank, and the bank manager is obviously an American, so he greets them, and he takes them downstairs and whatever. That guy pulls a face when he turns around. I laughed out loud. I went, okay, it's on me. He just closes the door himself and gives him the keys.
Yeah, but it's very great. Similar to the train robbery scene, which is sort of like, I know that you guys are here just for the money and you don't want to hurt anyone. However, I do have a job here.
Okay, open up in there.
I work for Mr. E.A. Terriman of the Union Pacific Railroad.
Hey, and Woodcock!
What?
You okay?
Well, sort of.
Hey, that's wonderful. Let's take a look at you.
Well, now, Butch, you gotta have more respect for me than to think that I'd ever fall for a stunt like that.
You can't want to get blown up again.
Butch, you know that if it were my money, there is nobody that I would rather have steal it than you.
And again, when they go to their informant, and he's like, what are you doing here? You know what? Just make it look like, you know, that you really beat me up and all that. So those sort of scenes are very telling to their characters and how they conduct business. But with the music of Burt Bacharach...
I know. But hey, the movie wouldn't feel that way without it. So there's something about it, right? When they use too much dynamite and there's money flying around, it's the first time you see Redford laughing, and it feels like a proper friendship. It feels exactly like a good friend, the way they would react when that shit happens. It's like, and the explosion, everything, the power, from a technical standpoint, it really works. Like, it's a big explosion but it's even their reaction. And also, you mentioned that there's a lot of the stunts, even the entire bike sequence is him until the last thing. The last thing is, I think it's someone pedaling backwards right before he goes into the bullpen. That, you can see that it's not him. But otherwise, that's Paul Newman.
Yeah,
you go and get a bicycle and do shit like that. Go do it.
I will.
Even the fact that they put Catherine Ross on the paddles at the front of the bike and she's not wearing shoes. Like a health and safety standard these days, that would never happen. They just wouldn't allow it.
But Tarantino was very happy about that scene. Very happy.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, he was.
I don't know. I thought of Riggs and Martha quite a bit, because I think that entire model for that friendship and the dynamic is based on this movie, guaranteed. Yeah. But I then looked, I think it's the director of photography, the cinematographer of this, he did Maverick as well. Because I need to go revisit that for some reason. I'm sure that it's not worth revisiting, but...
I actually watched it a few years ago.
I liked it when it came out.
Yeah, I saw it in cinema. And I watched it a few years ago again. It's okay.
Mm.
It has got some good scenes. But, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look, the sepia tone opening of this movie and the entire thing on the table feels very Western, you're right. But there's a very modern take on the line delivery, and that it's not sarcasm. It's just only Paul Newman could have delivered that way, which he starts whispering to his ear, and then he goes around the table, and the entire set piece is perfect. And he goes, they're toying, basically. They know exactly how this is going to end. But it's just the way he goes, hey, man, look, he could draw on you.
Yeah, you're a hell of a card player, fella. I know, because I'm a hell of a card player. And I can't even spot how you're cheating. The money stays, and you go.
Well, we seem to be a little short on brotherly love around here.
If you're with him, you better get yourselves out of here.
We're on our way. Come on, I wasn't cheating. Come on. I wasn't cheating.
You can die. For that matter, you can both die.
You hear that? If he invites us to stay, then we'll go.
We're going to leave anyway.
He's got to invite us to stick around.
He'll draw on you. He's ready. You don't know how fast he is. I'm over the hill, but it can't happen to you.
That's just what I want to hear.
Every day you get older. Now, that's a law. What would you think about maybe asking us to stick around?
What?
You don't have to mean it or anything. Just ask us to stick around. I promise you. I can't help you, Sundance.
I actually now miss Paul Newman. I want to go back, which, by the way, Paul Newman, again, these people have worked together like a lot. Road to Perdition with Tom Hanks and Newman. Yeah. You remember that one? Same director of photography. If you look at this guy's pedigree, holy shit. What's his name again? Conrad Hall. Loads of stuff, dude. This guy has done basically all the big movies we grew up with. Like, he's, you know, these are titans. That's why this movie looks good. Not just because, you know, it's not coincidence. Mm. These are, you know, titans in the industry.
I've just had another tonal shift moment reminder.
Which one?
Is them trying to learn Spanish.
Spanish.
And but it's also not only them trying to learn Spanish, but the point where the Sundance kid is trying to get on with Etta after a hard day or whatever it is, and she's like, no, you've got to say the phrase. And again, I'm not shaming a kink, but she then tries to get Butch Cassidy in on it. So she's got something about her auditory senses and that she needs to have all those holes filled at the same time, I guess. But...
Oh, my God. You just ruined the edit of this show. Okay, this is a point. And actually, the movie is not shy about it either, because she says, Etta says that too. So what if we met, you know, what if we met before, whatever? But the thing is, you can see that the friendship they have has boundaries, like between Butch and Sundance, right? They're proper friends. And in fact, apparently there's something in a prequel. There's several different types of mediums where this story is being told at different times of their arc, you know what I mean? Like, so I would love to know more. The problem is that whatever it's written, whatever they shot, whatever it's been made that is for entertainment purposes, is still based on two historical figures. And, you know, it's heavily romanticized. It's gotta be. It's gotta be.
Yeah.
You know, there is an ounce of truth in this movie, for sure. You know, like, at the end of the day, these were criminals. So even the part where Cassidy's saying, I've never killed anyone, I don't know. You know, it works for this movie, but I'm not interested. I'm not interested in that. I want more fiction written about these two characters. Fiction. So, and also, the freeze frame, I wouldn't fantasize about anything that came after. They die. They die horribly. And there is a moment which is like proper, the classical structure of the narrative of any drama, where there's the Harbinger or the Oracle. There's a figure that will tell the protagonist their fate, you know, their destiny ahead of, you know, it actually happening. And it happens in this movie. When they go and see the sheriff, he goes, weird deal, what are you doing? You can't just barge in here. And Paul Newman's pleading with him. They're trying to find the solution because this unstoppable force, which we're going to talk about in a moment, because there's no other movie that does this well. And again, it's a message, and it's a strong message here. Because every other Western before this one was all about the law. It was all about the righteous. You know, you wouldn't get a Pulp Fiction without this movie, probably, because the two protagonists of that movie, the movie opens with us sympathizing with killers, with contract killers, criminals. And it's the same thing here. These guys are the protagonists for the first time, and the unstoppable force, there's a reason why they're almost faceless. One line that keeps being repeated throughout this movie is like, who are those guys? Because they never stop.
I couldn't do that. Could you do that? How can they do that? Who are those guys? They're not going for it. Who are those guys?
You're beginning to get on my nerves. Who are those guys?
They never stop. They symbolize your past catching up with you. They symbolize, you know, being on the run from this thing that is relentlessly about to get you. So the ending of this movie is inevitable. But that's the thing that I remember about this movie, is who are those guys? It's the first time that the movie's almost denouncing that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, the fact that the good guys will always come on top no matter what. And this time around, that freeze frame, I you know that they are dead, because that guy, to go back to the sheriff and what he says to them, he says, you will die in a bloody horrible way.
But it's also, the second Cassandra moment is actually from Etta. She said, you know, I will come with you, but I am not, the one time I will leave you is I will not watch you die. And that's when
she
leaves.
Exactly. Yeah. And she does, yeah. It's, fuck it, dude. You're right, there are tonal shifts in this one, but the movie wouldn't be what it is without them. I don't know, that's the only way. I probably wouldn't accept them in any other movie. And we have criticized movies for that before, I think.
Yeah, look at a situation where they go back to the Hole in the Wall gang, which is also the Wild Bunch, if you take into consideration the history.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Hole in the Wall gang, which technically would be called the Wild Bunch, but the problem with this is that there was another movie which came out like 2 months before called The Wild Bunch, which featured about the gang itself. So they aptly renamed it The Hole in the Wall Gang, which is where they go. But we get to see that fight scene with Ted Cassidy, who's Lurch in The Addams Family.
Oh, Harvey.
Which is,
man, you piece of shit. I was going to fucking drop that one later.
No. What? Come on. But you get that comedy moment as well. It's a comedy moment. Loads. It's perfect.
That, by the way, the physicality of Newman in that fight.
Yeah.
Fucking breppy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the way he goes from static to movement back to static.
Mm.
It was uncanny. It blew my mind. You could summarize Brad Pitt's entire career and its kinetic presence on screen by looking at this performance by Paul Newman. I challenge every single one of our listeners to go watch this movie. And why are you laughing, Steve?
Because it's true.
Because it's fucking true. But how the fuck did I not pick this up before?
Because I didn't pick it up. I've always seen Brad Pitt as a Robert Redford.
And I agree with that as well. Like but now I think we got Gosling going for the Redford presence.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I was going to say, because of the release of this film, and before this film there were anti-heroes. There was Scarface in the 30s. There was Bonnie and Clyde previously to this film. But I feel like because of this film, because of the comediness, the duo-ness, international cinema wouldn't be the way it was. There's something very Bollywood about this film. There's something very East Asian trying to harp. You can see elements of The Good, the Bad, and the Weird in this film. There is a lot about this film that has been replicated over and over again across many international markets. And that just shows you the reach of this film from its like little small, well, I say little small beginnings. Those explosions must have cost a bomb. Those trains must have cost a bomb. So much that must have cost so much.
Dude, this was a financial success. Like 6 million and made 102 reportedly only in North America. 4 Oscars. In 69, dude, this movie made 102 million in 69. It's a colossal success.
4 Oscars. It won 4 Oscars. It's crazy. But 22 wins and 15 nominations.
There you go. Which screen are you reading this from?
The one in the top corner.
IMDb. One on the right.
You go 8 screens now, right? You're doing your fucking Tom Cruise Minority Report.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. Yeah. I keep telling you, it's only 2 screens. Fuck you.
You're talking about the return, but even before the return, this was the highest selling script in Hollywood for the time. It took 400,000 just to secure the script, and then another 200,000 for like additional rights or putting on the schedule or something. It was something I heard in one of the documentaries that Fox really went for it, like really was just like, put as much money on it as possible, secure it, make sure we've got the filming locales, make sure we've got the talent. This is going to be it. This is going to be the big one.
But the original script was also called Sundance Kid and Butch Cassidy.
Trust Bolito.
Pardon? Which is kind of crazy.
For sure.
Yeah, it was. Sure. It's only because Newman got raised up.
You raise me up so I can stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong when I am on your shoulder.
Like, because we were talking about the script, for fuck's sake.
Oh, shit.
Come on.
Oh, man, you dropped that little puppet.
That was a clean drop. That, I've got to admit, Steve, that was an absolute clean drop. On the end of my fucktoid. Yeah.
Now, one thing about this one. I really hope, man, I would never tire of saying this, but I may spend a portion of this weekend looking at other classics with... Cool and Luke is one of my favorite movies. So we always talk about Cool. We talk about, you know, the Cary Grants or the Steve McQueens or whatever. We still get some of that. But I think Modern Life and the type of fame that you achieve these days as an actor will kind of limit like a spot of that kind with the way information moves these days, because that kind of cool, I think by modern standards, I think is almost unattainable. You don't have it anymore. And there are cool people out there. There are cool actors or actors that have that charisma, right? But fuck, man, I'll go as far as saying that Newman here is, like, there's something about him. It's like Bill Murray in comedy. It's when you don't have to do much. You just have to be. Do you understand? Like, it's like you were made to be in front of the camera. We're talking about like slight movements, like a slight squint or whatever. And that's cool. Am I wrong in saying, I don't want to say, oh, those of them, you know, there were different times. You see, there were better times. No, I'm not saying that, but I am. And I don't know if there's a place, like it's like the age of the crooner, for example, is over. You know, like it's maybe society has moved away from that. I don't know, but I also think that as an actor, you even if you reach that point, you wouldn't even get to it because your personal life could cast a shadow over the projection of the characters you played on screen very quickly. I don't want to know anything about Paul Newman's personal life. I know he did a lot of good, but he was probably offsetting some of the bad because you know that there's the hole in the wall gang or whatever. they started like a, I think Paul Newman started like a charity that is still running today for, is it for disadvantaged children or something like that, taking camping and stuff.
When I was a kid, camp was a place where I could hike, fish, meet new friends, raise a little hell. And it was that simple idea that started the hole-in-the-wall camps.
Our son lived for these 10 days at camp. It was what kept him going the whole rest of the year.
Nobody here stares at me because they all have problems like me. And so I feel comfortable.
The hole-in-the-wall camps are magical places where children with serious illnesses can kick back and just be kids. Today, the Hole in the Wall Association has grown to a family of camps around the world, hosting more than 15,000 children a year. But there's still more that needs to be done.
We want kids everywhere to be treated fairly and kindly. Because if everyone is treated kindly, then this can be a better world.
Come see how you can help at www.holeinthewallcamps.org.
So they've done a lot. There was a lot of charity work. But also there's, you know, it's kind of nebulous when it comes down to their personal lives. By today's standards, with the internet and everyone having a fucking camera in their pocket or whatever, I don't think that you'll get there. You don't get to that level of cool because something will come out in the open and it will be spread across the world so quickly. Mm-hmm. It will kind of mar your image. I don't know. You understand what I'm trying to say?
No, I don't know. I see your point, and it's come true over and over again. So I'm not saying that your point isn't correct. But I also think there's another level here, which is like, look at cinema nowadays. I know this is going off topic, but you guys saw Superman. When did you see Superman? 2 months ago? 3 months ago?
Yeah.
No, that's not the point.
I was about to forgive Steve for this one. Why are you bringing this up?
No. Listen. Because it's just come out on streaming here. So I can now watch it on HBO Max. And my point is that the landscape is so different. The fact that a film can be released 2 or 3 months ago and then, you can watch it on your phone 2 months later.
You're talking about the disposable nature of it all, right?
Yeah, and it's not the same thing anymore. Like, to be a star now, to be somebody who's, like, you know, they're barely getting any money anymore. Like, not only the producers, but actually the actors aren't really getting money anymore.
They're getting paid less, I guess.
Yeah, and their notoriety isn't there. They have to be in a long-running TV series that goes for more than 2 seasons for them to be even noticeable on the worldwide market nowadays, which makes it the public zeitgeist, because it's, you know, to be a star now, not only do you have to navigate social media and whatnot, but you've also got to navigate short attention spans in terms of like, what have you done for me recently? So
that's true.
It's, you know, you can't get Paul Newman, you can't get
what have you
get
done for
Robert
me lately.
Yeah,
is that you quoting Lee Murphy? Yeah. Is that from you lately? Was that from Raw or from?
I think it was from Raw.
Janet Jackson got a hit record. What have you done for me lately? That's what they've been thinking. What have you done for me lately? The record start off like that. I know he used to do shit for you, but what has he done for you lately? Baby, I love you. What have you done for me lately? You're the only thing on my mind. What have you done for me lately? We make good love. What have you done for me lately?
But my point is that to be like, actually, you've picked somebody great there, Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy has only stood the test of time because of our generation.
He pulled away for a long time. He was about to go recluse, man. He was about to go recluse when he lost the funny. Because he lost the funny. You know, when you make too much money, you can't relate anymore. That's it's over.
But it's not even that. It's the fact that he didn't need to, because he was still getting royalties from this, that, and whatever. He doesn't need.
You could see that he suffered. He suffered at one point. I mean, you can have all the money in the world.
You know, having a child with Melanie Brown from Spice Girls, that is going to make you suffer quite a bit.
No. I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about, because don't forget that the humble beginnings of Eddie. You know, Eddie Murphy started as a comedian. And that's an outlet. That's artistic expression. If then he achieves stardom, making that kind of money will stop pulling you away from being relatable. And I think that's a double-edged sword. You know, he didn't just start as an actor. He started as a stand-up comedian, dude. So,
but the point is that he hit a height only because of the generation he was in. So he hit a height because even if you don't
he was good though.
No, but even if you the Nutty Professor brought money. Like
he did, but it was the beginning of the end for him. Like,
but it doesn't matter because, like, even people, some people I meet now who are my age, they go, "Oh yeah, I remember Meet Dave." You know, just some of the really wacky, crappy Eddie Murphy films. But he got money for. You know, my point is that we won't get stars like that anymore because of the way that media gets shoved into people's faces. You know, we're not the person closest to all of this is people like The Rock, but like, what has The Rock really
done? Although
see,
he has a desire of proving something else because all the money in the world is go whatever the fuck, but he wants to be recognized as an actor, hence why he took the smash. I gotta watch that, see what's going on there.
Yeah, same, yeah,
I'm gonna give it a chance.
It's been getting good reviews,
I get it, you get trapped, right? But this proves the point. You kept mentioning money, and I'm talking about legacy here, you know, like, so whatever medium you're in. If you make it to the level of stardom, it means that you had humble beginnings. It means that it was some kind of artistic expression that took you there. And that's, I guess that's the limitation of, you know, a remarkable arc, you know, story arc for anyone that started because they needed to do something. Mm. It was like a compulsion. That's art, right? It's the need for expression. And when you get that good at it and you start getting paid a lot, what happens then? You know what I mean? If it was pain, if it was something, what happens to the influence of all these things, new things that come into your life? It's a mind fuck.
Mm.
It's a mind fuck to keep it together. You know, like, you have to go through an entire journey of rediscovering who the fuck you were if you manage to reinvent yourself. You know, there was only one person that I can think of immediately that managed to reinvent themselves, not just because of the level of notoriety, but also times changing, and that's David Bowie.
And my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes. Don't wanna be a richer man. Changes.
That's a rare thing to do, to be able to adapt to changes, literally, and still be at the top.
Yeah,
it's especially
insane.
When we get people like Brando. Who, you know, was Brando, that was it. And he ultimately was his demise.
His demise, yeah. But he also always had, like, let's just say that it wasn't like a standard personality type. Like, Brando was conflicted always since the beginning.
But
have you seen The Offer? The series called The Offer?
No.
Yeah.
It's great. It's basically like a fictionalized version of the making of The Godfather, you know, like, but it's one season, I think, and it's phenomenal. It's just you should watch it just to see the guy, the young actor they picked to play Pacino, you know, because he's fucking bananas. It's carbon copy.
I think my point was, like, I totally understand all of that because that's focusing on the star or the actor or the producer or whoever. But my point was actually pointing more towards the audience. The people who make legacies, who make people who are a legacy, are the audience. Is there an audience out there to make a legacy of anyone? No, because they keep making legacies or making popular people out of YouTubers, like the Pauls or...
30 seconds.
Yeah. You know.
But also, let's try and stay objective here, which is we are kind of falling out of touch with that. And you know what? I'm cool with that. I'm completely cool with that.
No, but that's
there's a
fine.
Ton of other entertainment that it's relatable to me that I'm still discovering. All right, I'm running out of it. Hence, you know, why we're going out of our way sometimes to either talk about something that we already experienced, or it really it gets real good when we talk about something new that it's that it's special. You know, we talk about the horror genre, for example, being an outlet for that now.
But my big worry is that, you know, we've got...
Oh, you got kids. You should be worried.
Yeah, my big worry is that we've got, like, actors like Benicio del Toro. He should be a legacy by now. The amount of different characters, the amount of different parts of our zeitgeist that he's been a part of, he should be a legacy by now. We've got actors like Paul Dano, and we all know why I love Paul Dano, but he has been different and across the zeitgeist all over the place. You know, he's gone from, like, Oscar-nominated films to low indie films where he's, like, amazing. But they're not legacy actors anymore, but not because they're not doing the work, but because the audience out there now just doesn't even know where to pay attention. It's crazy. Yeah.
But look, you don't concern yourself with that either. We're talking about there's still great actors out there. But this is different. Redford, Newman, here, this is a whole different thing. And I think that's gone. I think that would not repeat. Also, from a genetic standpoint, it's just his features. There's something about him. There's something, the combination of the lines on his face, the color of his eyes, that icy thing, and just doing a lot with doing very little. That's the thing that impresses the most about these guys. In this movie, there's a lot of emotion being conveyed by... There's a lot of nuance. Just
nuance, yeah.
Nuance. But, you know, they're very subtle performances for characters that are larger than life. You know, the entire sequence about them jumping from the fucking rocks into the waterfall, even the comedy, just the way it's paced and their exchange, it's fucking gold. It's gold. It's, you know, now you get Kevin Hart going, jumping the water. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, yeah. it's fucking nightmare.
There's no nuance there.
Yeah. The Rock and fucking Kevin Hart going,
And him going, you're going to get into the water.
Dude, again, the comedic bits of this movie are phenomenal. When even it's, I'll give you an example for me, and I think I'll make a point very poignantly here. If you watch Ghostbusters as many times as I have seen it, there's a moment in which Dan Aykroyd shows stupor by opening his mouth, and his cigarette sticks to the bottom lip and stays there for a bit. It's subtle and it's iconic because it's a small thing. I don't even know if it happened by mistake or whatever, but it's the essence of stupor. You know what I mean? Like, it's, and there's a lot of that shit going on in Ghostbusters of just being, you know, or just being able to be and exude what it goes beyond acting, right? Not everybody has it. In this movie, there's a lot of sequences. I'll give you an example. When they get to Bolivia, and you know what's coming, right? You know, because there's silence. They look around. There's an alpaca. There's a little piglets and stuff. And you can see. You know exactly what. You know. You can hear those beats coming. Redford drops the bags to the ground. And it's subtle, but it's, you know, it's like, I had it. it's not emphasized. It really just opens his hands and it's in the background. And this movie is rich with stuff like this. And I don't know, that subtlety hitting so hard. It's just not the way we do things anymore. I think it's, whoa. This movie's, But with all this being said, as we're sitting on the couch, I said to Anne, I don't know, you know, this is a vehicle for both of them. And I picked this with the guys. I wish they challenged me this time around. You guys didn't. No. I picked the movie. You didn't say anything. You just went, all right. But obviously, we wanted to celebrate Redford. And at the moment I said this to her, I went, no, no, no. She stops me. She goes, you should have done Great Gatsby. And I'm like, oh, fuck.
No, I prefer this. 100%.
Yeah, but it's more centric to Redford, right?
Of course.
Even, like, we could have gone in the 80s, the 90s, that other stuff. Like, even The Horse Whisperer, apparently it's really good. I don't remember it at all. There's other stuff that he's done.
So the misfire is actually, yeah, no, it was All the President's Men. That's the misfire that we had. Yeah.
Yes, but there, again, he's almost overshadowed by Hoffman, man.
Mm-hmm.
Dustin Hoffman is fucking forced to be reckoned with in that one. Like, it's...
Yeah, and you Hoffman, know what? You know what?
Thank God he plays the straight man there as well, right? He plays the one that keeps it together. Like, it's the way they bounce off each other. That energy is
No, thank God that you picked this one, because undeniably, to most people, Robert Redford in this is just cool.
Yeah.
Oh, he's very cool.
He's just cool.
He's very cool.
He's just that amazing sort of, and even the scenes where he's actually the butt of the joke, he's still cool. Mm-hmm. You know, he should. There's a scene where he shoots a snake without even knowing it's there. He's cool.
Oh, and did you just see the way he turns around to him and just fucked up? But it's so subtle. It's like I just gave away our position.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's like boom, done.
Yeah. Because they've been chased for what seems to be days by now. Like it's.
Yeah.
And look, even the repetition, because that line, like I said, Hammers at home, like they keep going, who are these guys?
Who
it becomes like a joke throughout the. It's like four or five times. It's so iconic. I want a t-shirt that says, who are these guys? But it's on the back. You know what I mean?
I actually loved the little things that we're trying to break down who is actually following them. It's like, oh, that tracker we met.
What's his name? The name of the Native American Indian trek lord he's got. And in fact, there's a joke about that as well. Because he goes, no, he's got an English name. Like it's Lord something. What's it called?
I don't think he comes up in the cast. Lord.
Yeah.
No, he won't come up in the cast.
Because you don't get to see him. So.
No, you don't get to see him. And it's better that way. Lord Baltimore is the Indian
trek. Full-blooded Indian. Yeah. Oh, hold on. Denver. When we were in that film, Denver, Lord Baltimore. Baltimore. Yeah.
Which, by the way, when little by little you're trickled, at least the names, just to highlight the gravity of the situation that they're in, because these things are not stopping. And I think they wanted to probably not reinforce the almost supernatural element attached to them, because they are relentless. Day and night, they are still after them. You know what I mean? And the way they are portrayed, you can see mad paintings, in a lot of sequences, at least in the stream that I watched, which, by the way, to our UK listeners, you can watch this movie on Disney+.
And in Australia too, please watch it on Disney+, which currently has ESPN content for the NFL games, which you can watch for at least a week after they have been aired. That, again, is the Disney+ ESPN content in Australia.
Yeah. Lots of good value in the subscription by Disney, I've got to say. Would you recommend it?
I'm currently watching Alien Earth on Disney+.
Oh, that's available as well.
Which is also available.
You know who else kind of decided that this wasn't quite what they were looking for? Hi, how you doing? It's all good? Yes. And I'm ready to chat to you guys about this film, which is known as the ultimate in groupthink for cinema myths. I saw this when it came out at the theatre. I was a high school kid. Even then, it was boring. The movie did fit the zeitgeist of the time perfectly. Antiheroes equals counterculture. I remember people dressing up like the characters of Redford, Newman and Ross and getting photographs and sepia enlargements for the proud display. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head was a huge pop hit and stands up well today. And so this movie was all about the music. I don't think popular music has ever been used in a Western before, which explains much of its appeal. The music video to the vocal pop song Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head had Cassidy the Kid and Ella. The music rarely induced any kind of excitement or suspense either. It lost my interest after the music video, however, and went seriously begging for plot through the end. Bad direction and editing was to blame here. There was too much filler. In the end, this is a movie which relies on music, the pairing of Redford and Newman in their prime, cute banter and MTV slickness, but lacks in any substance whatsoever. I hate to offend so many people, but I think the high ratings are from who accept pop culture myths without thinking for themselves, or who haven't seen the movie since its release, since they grew up, now without the zillions of dollars of promotion, which made the myth before the myth was ever seen. The ultimate in groupthink. You just cannot watch this now and write a favorable review unless you specify the first third. If you were alive when it came out, watch it again to see the truth. If you weren't, don't bother. You will never get the time back. Funny, I almost didn't watch it today, as I always thought of it rather boring, and wondered what didn't I get that everyone else seemed to. I did, and it was. Thank you. Carmia, 2002, written in July 12th, 2018.
Fuck you. fuck that guy, fuck this segment.
Wow.
I'm telling you.
That guy had some opinions there, didn't he? Thank you.
Yeah, I know. Just like assholes, everybody's cold, right? It's, we should give a little bit of credit to the performance of Strother Martin. He plays the prospector, yeah. The guy that gives them the job when they try to go straight. Percy Garris, that's as great as that. That entire sequence. And also this pairing of him spitting and saying bingo every time.
So you want jobs. You're from the U.S. of A. and you are seeking after employment. Well, you couldn't have picked a more out-of-the-way place in all of Bolivia, I'll tell you that. Gracias, Jesus. Ordinarily, you've got to wait to work for Percy Garris. But this ain't ordinarily. Bingo.
Perfect.
And then justifies calling himself colorful by saying that 10 years living alone in Bolivia would make you colorful. And he gets fucking shot in the chest. Out you go, like Game of Thrones. Just as I was liking this character. I think we all collectively recommend this movie, I assume, to anyone. Yeah,
really. We recommend it.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, it's essential. I think it's ratings time.
I'll go first. Because you guys are just going to vilify me anyway, so it's okay. I am going to give this one a 7.9. Now, I actually felt very much on this watching, very similar to what Siskel and Ebert felt when they watched it all the way back in the 70s, which was the feeling of there's a little bit too much of a tonal shift going on constantly throughout this film. So there's a little bit of stop-starty. But I cannot get past the fact that there are so many scenes in this film that have started, explored, and actually set a bar for so many other films afterwards. So I was going to come in here and kind of give it a low, like what we would consider a lowish rating. But through this conversation, remembering stuff like the explosions, the stunts, the first 15 minutes and the last 15 minutes. There's so much going on within this film that, yeah, it's a bit of a masala film. It's a bit of a have a little bit of everything. And, yeah, this is a PG. You can put this on in the afternoon and you can expose this to anybody and just hope that they don't understand the whole scene where it's almost like kink shaming. But I cannot get over the fact that the last 15 to 20 minutes of this film is pure cinema gold. You can take that scene, put it in any school or any lecture.
It's almost like it invented the fucking freeze frame, dude.
Forget about even the last scene. I mean everything. The setting up of the Bolivian police. The conversation that they have while they're both bleeding on the floor, trying to figure out what they're going to do next. There's so much about the emotionality and the tone of the last 20 minutes that it's cinema gold. It's cinema gold.
You know, when the... Sorry to interrupt you, because we're on the... When the army comes in, right?
Yeah.
I love when the guy goes, two guys... You've got the army here. You got all of us here for two guys.
Mm.
And then he goes, no, but it's the two.
It's the Gringos.
Yankees. Yeah. And he goes, oh, okay.
Yeah. But that whole last 20 minutes, you can put it in any lecture and you can talk about tonality. You can talk about lighting. You can talk about just there's so much to talk about, you know, without even mentioning the last frames. Oh, actually, even it's not even frames. It's the last frame. So it was going to be lower, but now I've taken it up to 7.9. I believe that's higher than my Hot Shots review. So I think that makes 7. Everybody 5. Happy. That it is higher than
4
Hot
points
Shots.
More.
Yeah, yeah. Four points more. Come on.
Point four more than Hot Shots 2. Unbelievable.
Anyway, it's a 7.9 gringos at the door waiting to be shot.
Nice. So, I love this movie, and I'm not going to say it's a 9 or a 10. This is an 8.5 for me. it's got its problems, but it's a good movie. I mean, you can sit down, you can watch it. There are some really nice highlights to this. And there's some great acting. And some good comedy. And like Umba's brought up so many times, the buddy cop kind of feel to it. You can see this was a genesis of that. You can feel it straight away.
Exactly.
Even the bit with a snake. It's just fucking great effects. Because it's the look that Redford gives straight afterwards. And you can see, yeah, this is... I've just fucked up. Oh, shit. And you carry on running. And it is a case of carry on running for 22 minutes or something like that, which is fantastic, especially with the dust trail in the background. So you can just see it glimmering up. It was fun to revisit. Mm-hmm. I was kind of confused by the sepia tones because I couldn't remember at the beginning of the movie it being in sepia. Mm-hmm. I could remember it being color. That's how my brain remembered it.
I was confused by that as well.
And
it's a nice transition.
It was a very nice transition because you had this kind of from dusk till dawn kind of feeling to it. I mean, it's got its problems. I'm not the biggest fan of the bicycle scene. And I fucking hate raindrops falling on my head. fuck. I hate that track. So I probably knocked it down a good 0.5 of a point purely on
that
fucking song. But at the time, it was popular.
So it's an 8.5 what?
It's an 8.5 Bolivian Bandits being shot on a hill.
Oh, right. Ouch. Okay. And your 7.9, Ricky, what was it?
It was Gringos at the Door, waiting at the door.
All right. I picked this movie. For some reason, I wish you guys challenged this one and put something down, but you guys went along with it. We wanted to celebrate Redford, and you know what? I have no regrets. I think this is a fantastic vehicle for both of them. I'll go as far as calling this movie compulsory watching. Like, you need to watch this. Not just because it's because it's a genesis of a lot of the tropes that, you know, we're familiar with today. You know, sometimes that's, you know, when you look at prototropes or where something started, we kind of see that as a starting point and then, you know, we either praise the evolution of it or where we are now, but this is different. This is like when it started, and I think it's one of the highest watermarks of it still, you know. And it's also like from an acting standpoint as well, it's doing a lot with doing very little, and that's fucking cool. To me, that's the essence of cool. It's when you make something great seem effortless. And I think these guys did that very well. Not just in this movie, but their entire career. You know, you could just be and exude that presence, whatever role, you know, they were placed in. It's a shame we lost Redford. I hate to say this. I hate it when, you know, he had a good run. He was 89 or whatever. But the guy did a lot for this medium. You know, just the Sundance Film Festival alone and spearheading a movement at a time in which everyone, there was a desire to do that, to change things, counterculture itself, right? So this movie is representative of a lot of things, but at the same time, you could also categorize it as light entertainment. You know, it could have gone hard on messages or any kind of moralism, and it doesn't. You know, you get a hint of it because the time, it was inescapable. You had to do that, right? Certain things you just can't brush over, but it didn't insist upon them. So yes, it's got a PG feel to it, but it's memorable. So this is also an 8.5 for me. That was a score I had in my head. I wasn't influenced by you, Steve, but I had it in my head. Yeah. And the only reason why is because even if it's necessary to the story and services the story, the entire sequence, it feels like the second act of this movie is running away. And I get it, and it's essential, because one of the most important things that attracted me to this was that message in the movie, the fact that, you know, this unstoppable force of the law, or even the representation of your past catching up with you. You know what I mean? Like, at some point, it will get you. And that's what happens here. So I like that. But the movie, again, doesn't sit on these. So, because I would get heavy. it's the movie feels light. So that's why, for some reason, even like Raindrops on My Head or whatever the fuck adds to that lightness. You know, it's like the movie's trying to steer away from the darkness, and it does it really, really well. You know, I recommend it to anyone. I think it's great. I just wish we can have more of that magic, if possible. I'm hopeful. I know that if you look for it, it's still out there. So that's it. We just have to wait, I guess. And on that note, this was Umba.
This was Steve.
And this was Ricky.
You can run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me with a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He called my name and my heart stood still when he said, John, go do my will. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. You can run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down.